Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Aliyah Mary, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society.
We would like to welcome Dr. Laura Nimmin to Research Review today. Dr. Nimmin's a scientist at UBC's Center of Health Education Scholarship and an associate professor in UBC's Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. It's a pleasure to have you on today.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's really an honor. Thanks.
Of course. Could you maybe start by telling us a bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. As you mentioned, I work in the area of health professions education, but actually my background is in literacy, language and literacy. And so I kind of came into the field of health professions education in sort of an unexpected way, which has been a wonderful journey. But during my doctoral work, I was focusing on health, and I lived in a small rural community outside of Vancouver, and I did an ethnography, which means that I was studying culture and cultural practices in this small community, and I was actually kind of mapping and tracing the ways that social networks shape how patients interpret and make meaning of their health. And so I spent a lot of time in the community. I went to like Saturday farmers markets, and I volunteered in the bookstore and a homeless shelter, and went to hospital meetings and family barbecues, and I even went to the pub. So I like literally just lived in the community and was hoping that eventually people wouldn't even notice I was there. And taking those kind of like in-depth ethnographic field notes. And so I was sort of documenting how people talk about health and what they were reading, like what kind of food coupons they took to the grocery store, what they read in newspapers and so on. And so this idea of how kind of people were interpreting health information, how it flowed in social networks, it interfaced with the healthcare system, became a central focus of my work. But like during my PhD, like most PhD students, I had to pay the bills. and so I had, I was always looking for research assistant jobs. And so there was this kind of cool posting that came up for at the Center of Health Education Scholarship. And it was a study led by Dr. Lorelei Lingard, and she was using a complex adaptive systems theory to understand how healthcare teams communicate and coordinate care for heart failure patients. So I was super excited about the project just because it interlaced a lot with my own focus on networks and my interest in expanding kind of the boundaries of how we understand healthcare to sort of be situated more in the community. And so when I applied for the job, I got this job as a research assistant at CHESS, and I literally never left, and I'm still in the field of health professions education. So,
yeah. When it comes to health education, so like health professions education, would you be talking like med school professors, or like are we talking about how like attendings, maybe like supervised residents, or how what sort of things are you referring to?
So it's like a really broad spectrum health professions education. It can, it, you know, focuses on how learners learn in the educational setting, and even issues such as like their socialization into medical education or health professions education. But originally the field did stem from medical education, and then what became kind of grew into a broader field of health professions education. And I think it's a really, really new field, like relatively speaking to other fields. So it's about 50 years old. And it's a really neat area because it draws in PhDs from lots of different disciplines. So, you know, I work with people with a background in systems engineering or rhetorical studies or complexity theory, and so all kinds of different backgrounds. And Canada is actually one of the leaders in the world in the field of health professions education, and I think it's because there's a really strong focus on collaboration and networking. So it's like a super vibrant space and fun space to work in, and I feel really privileged to be in the area because I'm constantly being pushed to my own boundaries of my own thinking. So, but to answer your question, go back to your question, we kind of dance around every area of healthcare practice and education and all levels of education.
Yeah. So one idea that really stood out to me is that, like, to use the med school example, there's some med school professors that aren't primarily teachers. Like, that's not what they spend most of their time doing. And then you, like, compare that with a high school teacher, and they spend, like, years of gaining education, like, on how to, like, be a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then they spend their whole lives doing just that. How do you think that sort of leads to the quality of education, you think?
I think it leads to a lot of variability, probably. I mean, I'm just speaking off the cusp, but I think some people are probably natural teachers and they have this sort of way of being with all kinds of people where they're good at working with patients or they're good at teaching learners, and they have a kind of very strong sort of social and humanistic approach to interacting with people. And whereas for others, they have to kind of work hard at learning how to be that way. And so, and I, you know, there's not a lot of probably like screening in terms of who can be a clinical teacher, and not a lot of educating and support often. So in some of the work I've done, like even having a strong network of peers who are teachers can help cultivate a strong presence as a clinical teacher. And so, you know, I think that, it just depends on how we think about what a teacher is and what kind of skills they can offer and what kind of exposure they might have to a support system around them to help them learn to be a good teacher.
Yeah. Let's go into that social network part for a second. Could you maybe back up a bit and explain to the audience what social network analysis is?
Sure, yeah. It's basically a paradigm. So it's sort of a worldview that takes an interest in the patterns of relationships that form a social structure. And what threads the paradigm together is this orientation that the social world is relational, and so that reality emerges through relationships. So, you know, I think it's an approach to research that really intrinsically values interdependence, and it's an approach to education and learning as well.
Mm-hmm. So going back to your example of like, professors having a social network of other like professors that help strengthen their teaching. Could you maybe give some examples on how that could be the case? Like, would it just be through casual discussion over the water cooler, just like little tips and tricks on how to be a better teacher, or was it really boiled down to?
Yeah, I think we don't really maybe place a lot of value on those informal discussions that happen outside of like a faculty development setting on teaching. Those the formal kind of informal sort of networking and those informal spontaneous conversations can be really powerful precursor to like innovation in teaching or thinking about changing teaching practices or even showing vulnerability and saying to like a friend that or a peer that you trust, you know, I really don't know what to do in this situation, or I really need some help around this issue I'm having with teaching. And one of my students, Heather Buckley, actually studied that, the kind of informal networking that happens in faculty development and how it can, you know, be a really sort of a powerful tool for even like mobilizing knowledge and scaffolding knowledge and so on.
Now, on the topic of these, like, you know, the informal connections, one thing that this made me think about, you know, right now, especially like in the past year or two with all the online education that was going on, you know, we were really lacking a lot of these informal connections because everything was so structured and online, you know, communication was only through formal means such as email, phone call, or Zoom. You know, we didn't really have like people bumping into each other. So how would you say this really impacted the practice of teaching overall?
I think teachers, students have, you know, they weren't having those opportunities to bump into each other and kind of debrief their learning and maybe, you know, and even to meet new people where they could kind of bring in new ideas and diversify their network. So there might have been like some, I don't know, but just sort of speculating that there might have been some kind of siloing into the comfort of individuals that they already know, even finding it harder to reach out because they're not just, you know, able to kind of walk to their car after a session and chat with each other. So, you know, but I have heard of people creating kind of spontaneous spaces for informal interaction, like the private chatting on Zoom or using WhatsApp apps to create a group network of teachers or family physicians or whatnot, where they can interact and connect with each other, because more than ever, I think during the pandemic, we've realized how important that is mm-hmm. for a sense of social support as well and wellness.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
The haunting debut album Black Moon by Civic TV provides a cinematic backdrop, a modern-day symphony of the dark and light that is our collective reality. Take a listen to Black Moon, now available via Flemish Eye Records and on all streaming platforms.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Laura Nimmin, an associate professor in UBC's Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. So far in the past bit, we've talked a bit about Dr. Nimmin's background and also about her study of health professions education, and also a bit about social network analysis in terms of the interactions between educators and how those can really shape how teaching and learning really works. So Gurman, you had a question for Dr. Nimmin.
Yeah, for sure. I can only imagine how difficult COVID must be for like new teachers, where they maybe don't have like any social networks established within their field yet. So when it comes to like meeting new people and trying to develop their teaching, it can be quite difficult, I would imagine.
Yeah, and I think for learners too, you know, for the learners who were already, for example, in medical school, they already had those social ties and they built some social connections. But for individuals who are just coming into medicine or health, other health professions training programs, they didn't have those networks. And so, you know, it makes it almost challenging to kind of feel that sense of being socialized into the profession and having those friendships and relationships that can foster that sense of professional identity formation and support, I think, as you work through that system.
Yeah, I think identity formation is probably like a very huge part. Like from some of the like med students I know, a lot of them pick their like specialty based on just having conversations with other people and like learning about new fields that way.
Yeah, totally. I think those relationships are really key in terms of even having an impact, yeah, on a career selection. And so, yeah, it's just, I think, been really challenging for individuals who didn't have that exposure to the social networks that they need in a way to be able to kind of gain that type of advice and support and look for mentors and things like that. So
Could you maybe explain how social network analysis sort of works with like more formal discussions of teaching?
What do you mean formal discussions of teaching?
You mentioned like we've talked about some of the informal discussions people have within their social networks, but I would assume like they're also like professional development sessions and stuff like that, stuff that's more like I guess the word I could think of is formal is just like real, like a space where like it's designated for you to talk about that one thing.
I think that those spaces can help again, with this idea of identity formation, like if you're kind of teaching alone, when you have a more formal structure to go and debrief and talk about ideas and learning with other instructors, then it can kind of build your confidence and confirm your identity as a teacher, rather than this sort of siloing of teachers, where that sense of, you know, you may have a strong professional identity as like a clinician, but maybe not as a teacher, because you feel sort of isolated and siloed in your own teaching practices.
Yeah. What role do social networks play in like those formal like professional development sessions? Because I would imagine that like if everyone goes to that session, it doesn't really matter who's friends with who. You just like all speak up and talk with each other.
I think that they can be powerful in the sense that, you know, there's like in social network analysis, they're called isolates. So there are people who maybe bring an isolated perspective, but it's a really important perspective, and it can kind of pivot the way that people think about things and stimulate a sense of reflection about an important issue. So the group coming together can offer up these different perspectives that can be shared and enrich thinking about a problem. And even when it's, like I say, a really different perspective, that can be really important. And I think it just points back to that whole idea that the siloing of learning and of practice has some flaws.
Yeah, I can imagine that a whole lot of like paradigm shifts in medicine come from those like isolated thoughts, where people that aren't trapped in those bubbles are able to come up with their own ideas and able to like spread them to the general public.
Yeah, for sure. I think across any area, you see that as being really important in triggering change and change in perspectives and so on. So there's also research that shows that when teachers have like a more diverse network of teaching colleagues, that they tend to be better teachers than when they have a very sort of slim network of teachers. And I think it's just that idea of being able to talk to people about what you're learning and debrief and show vulnerability and weakness so that you can improve.
Yeah. What role does maybe like the nature of those relationships play? Like, for example, you see on TV, for example, it's the only thing I could think of where like attendings and residents sometimes have a really like standoffish and sometimes even like abusive relationship at times, where it's just like people are just forced to do all the scut work and they're often like yelled at and cursed out and those sorts of things. Does that play a role a lot in people's like professional development?
Absolutely. I think student mistreatment is a huge issue and is really on the is really being brought into the conversation in the health professions education literature. And there's a lot of really, it's not necessarily my own program of research, but I've worked and I'm working with people interested in that area where they look at student mistreatment and its various facets and the nature of reporting mechanisms and some of the flaws in the reporting mechanisms and the role of power and hierarchy in kind of manifesting and sustaining some of the student mistreatment. I work with a colleague who's really interested in students who experience mistreatment from patients, which I think is a really interesting kind of dimension to explore in terms of learners' overall experiences in the system and their sense of psychological safety.
Yeah, for sure. I remember you had like an interesting article a while back on exploring like the relationship of power between physicians and patients. And could you maybe talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so that paper, in coming into the field, I noticed there wasn't a lot of research that asked physicians like how they experience their power. And that kind of surprised me because they sit so high in the top of the hierarchy in the medical and healthcare sort of structure, social structure. And so I thought it really seems surprising to me that there was no research that kind of just explored like how do physicians experience their power, and particularly in their interactions with patients. So I just went out and asked physicians who are experienced, like, how do you experience your power and your interactions with patients? And it was kind of funny, like, when I asked the question, they seemed really surprised and almost taken aback. And so that was sort of one of my findings, was that clearly this question was not asked of them very often, and probably not really reflected on in their time in medical school anyways. It just seemed like such a shock. And I thought that was really interesting. And then there were kind of different categories of responses. Some physicians were super reflective about their power and how they kind of manage it ethically with patients, and had a lot of insight about their sort of execution and handling of their power and their interactions with patients. And then some of them talked about how there is no power. It's sort of like flattened out in this equal hierarchical structure with patients. And because of our whole kind of idealizing of patient-centered care, and so power is shared equally between physicians and patients. And then some talked about feeling bullied by patients. And so they kind of flipped our sense of power and felt that they were in a less powerful position than patients who were like super informed and requiring certain treatments and, care from physicians, and that they actually felt bullied by their patients. So there was like a really interesting range in terms of how physicians experience their power and their interactions with patients, and was just like a fascinating study to do, actually. And I really enjoyed that work and kind of doing a deep dive into that.
That last one is really interesting. The one where you mentioned how the power imbalance is kind of like inverted. So doctors feel like patients have the power. Could you, like, it's interesting because I've like never thought about it like that. Like, how would that like work in a way?
Yeah, I think they were talking about how patients are so informed because they have so much access to information. And so, and sometimes they come into the healthcare encounter armored with all of this information. And so the physician feels like challenged in terms of their own expertise being challenged by this slew of information that the patient brings in, whether it's correct or not.
Misinformation, I'm thinking. Sometimes. Like, if the patient like brings in misinformation, what would that look like?
Well, I think it can happen because in my own work, I've discovered how patients talk to so many people outside of the healthcare encounter about their health issue. And they might talk to like a brother who's had the same type of cancer, or a friend, and that person holds a lot of weight and influence in terms of how they interpret and make meaning of their health issue. And so they bring in a lot of, and they integrate a lot of different sources of information to make sense of their health condition. And that information is really meaningful and important to them. So I've talked in my work that it's, I think, better for healthcare providers to understand that system of meaning making that goes on in community and be open and curious about it and kind of almost expecting that to happen rather than being hostile and even placing the label of misinformation, but trying to be curious and like, why are you thinking that way? And who did you learn that from? And just this sense of kind of curiosity to kind of diffuse some of those tensions that can arise.
Yeah. Yeah. The first example that came straight to my head while you were saying that was COVID vaccines, for example. You have people that are very adamant sometimes on their beliefs, and often comes from just like anecdotal stories they hear about, like a friend who knows a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy that had this effect. So it's very interesting how those sorts of social networks can lead to patients having very adamant views on things.
And there's also like the whole like mistrust in authority piece these days, which could play into that. You know, there's like this, some people have this embodied sense of distrusting anyone who comes off as like, quote, qualified or credentialed or all that.
Yeah, and I think we need to be compassionate as to why people have mistrust in the healthcare system. Maybe there's some trauma there, like historical trauma or cultural trauma that leads them to have this sort of mistrust in the healthcare system. And so I think, and you're right. I mean, just COVID is a perfect illustration of how social networks and social relationships shape so strongly how people make sense of health information. And even it's often more powerful than what we consider to be expert information.
Yeah, I can only imagine what the sort of like politicization of some medical issues has played in some of the power dynamics between patients and physicians. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, like having like a very like just the wearing of a mask has become a political issue, and that could lead to some patients having very adamant views on things, and it could lead to this huge shift in power dynamics between patients and physicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, and I think that's cultural too. I think some cultures that are more individualistic have individuals in that culture have different sort of perceptions of their rights. And in other cultures that are more kind of communal, they maybe are more accepting of the kind of mandate to wear a mask. So I feel like culture really showed its true colors and its influence in COVID and was like extremely fascinating.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
The Sweetgrass Clan is a volunteer-based coalition that provides safety, security, and essential resources to the most vulnerable members of the downtown Eastside community. In addition to providing food and safety, the Sweetgrass Clan also connects people with advocates for housing, mental health counseling, and drug and alcohol detox. The Sweetgrass Clan is always looking for new volunteers to support the downtown Eastside community and are able to offer volunteers grocery gift cards and bus tickets as honorariums. If you would like to offer your volunteer support to the Sweetgrass Clan, you can reach out via email at abfrontdoor.org or visit abfrontdoor.org.
We're back here, and you're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirat, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Niman, an associate professor in UBC's Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. So far in the past bit, we've talked a bit about the power dynamics in medical settings, such as the one between residents and authority figures, and also the one between physicians and patients. And also, just before heading off on the break, we also talked a bit about misinformation and disinformation, especially in the topic of the coronavirus pandemic. So going on, Gurman, I think you had a question to ask.
Yeah, you bring up a really interesting point, because a lot of your researchers look through from like a critical theory lens, mm-hmm. and that could play a huge role in this sort of issue. Could you maybe explain to the audience what critical theory is and what role it plays in your research?
Yeah, so critical theory takes a position where reality is shaped by structures like social, political, cultural, and gender constructs. And the structures and cultural forces sort of interact dynamically to form this tapestry of social life. Sometimes these social structures and influences are unconscious, but they can sort of shape how people think and behave in a particular society or social group. So I can talk, if you want, about how this might be applied to health professions education, some interesting areas, if you like.
Yeah, go for it.
So I think right now, a really interesting conversation that's going on in the field related to critical theory and power is this recognition that there's a lack of women and physicians from groups underrepresented in medicine and academic leadership. And even though we know that kind of diversity in physician leadership can lead to reduced health disparities and improve population health, the progress towards this has really been painfully slow. And so even though it's kind of, this isn't my area of research, but I think it's really important to talk about and to name, and there's a lot of really interesting questions being asked right now in the field, like, why are we not seeing more representation of diversity in leadership? And how can we create these more inclusive environments? And so I think it's just really wonderful to see these conversations coming about, and I certainly stand in kind of solidarity with this work that's happening. But it does kind of ask us to take this critical theory perspective and dismantle these complex structural and social architectures that lead to this type of imbalance that's happened in healthcare and healthcare training. And so, like, a feminist, for example, critical theorist might try to examine how gendered hierarchies are happening in medical training and then how they're sustained over time. And they can constrain, for example, women trainees' future achievements in academic medicine. So critical theory is just a really useful theory to be able to unpack systems and structures and look at them from a power lens.
For sure. One thing that came to my head while you're talking about this is the idea that med schools now are sort of leaning towards this idea where, like, they have a pretty good, like, 50-50 gender split in most universities now. Like, I know UBC Med School usually has, like, a very slight majority women now in their med schools. And I'm wondering if that alone would translate into changes in leadership. Or do you think more needs to be done in that aspect?
No, it won't. But I think I think there has to be more done than just admission of, a balance of women and men, or, you know, sort of this type of representation where it's more balanced. I think that there needs to be a change as sort of at a structural level for women to feel welcome in the spaces of leadership and to feel that they have mentors in leadership who are there kind of to support them, who maybe share a similar experience. So I think there needs to be just a lot of different layers of change, like at all levels in the system, so that women are not only kind of recruited into these sort of top leadership positions, but they can, like, sustain themselves and feel that they want to stay in these positions because there's, like, a space for them there and a voice, and there's mentorship.
Yeah. Could you maybe help illustrate that with an example that's been suggested on how that could be facilitated?
I mean, I'm really speaking, like, outside of my area, but I do know, for sure, just even from personal experience, like, and a reflection of probably my own value system too. And I think it's well reported in the literature how powerful mentorship is, and that mentorship just plays a really important role in kind of retaining people in certain, in, like, not only sort of like the learning environment as you go through, your training program as, like, a medical student, you need the sense of mentorship and safety and psychological safety. And I've done some of that work with one of my students, Sean Sui, around psychological safety in the learning environment. Like, if you have the sense of mentorship and support where you don't feel that you're constantly being evaluated, it allows you to take risks and to ask difficult questions and to show when you don't know something and to kind of be in a state of flow, which is sort of a heightened learning space to be in where you're just really engaged in the moment. And so if you think about that, there's nothing to suggest that would change the higher up you go in your career. You need this sense of psychological safety and mentorship and support. And so if there's very few people like you in those roles, then it creates a big gap in terms of just having that sense of support around you that I think creates a sense of wellness and, you know, joy and satisfaction in work and learning.
Yeah. To add on to that point, I know in one of your articles, you used the example of Dr. Lee, who's this hypothetical medical trainee who makes a mistake when administering a drug to a patient. And you examine how Dr. Lee's gender could play a role in sort of his or her, like, how they view themselves and their responsibilities. Could you maybe talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, I think for that sample case, I'm just trying to refresh my memory. I think Lee was afraid to speak up. It was that, So I think that that is a big issue, and whether, you know, it plays an issue in terms of like gender and feeling maybe, you know, there's some kinds of power imbalances in terms of like from a gender perspective, but also just from a perspective of being a learner, where you are being assessed, you are being evaluated. You don't feel that you can make mistakes. You feel that it could kind of, you know, destroy your chances for like a placement that you need or whatever. And so I think our focus on like being sometimes like it's very implicit, but the kind of focus on being perfect and feeling like it's puts your career at risk to be vulnerable creates this type of environment where not only do you not want to speak up about a mistake that you make, but it can also kind of create this sort of sense of docility in the learning environment where you feel reticent to even resist anything, any type of kind of learning experience that doesn't feel right for you.
Yeah, I know in the example, you also talked about why Dr. Lee was given that responsibility in the first place. Like, for example, there are some tasks that may be given to a medical trainee that's generally given to a nurse, and the role that gender could play in that, as well as their sense of what responsibilities they have when they work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not uncommon for me to hear from colleagues who are female physicians that, you know, even patients always think first off that they're a nurse and not a surgeon. So there's just some really unconscious biases that circulate all across all levels of society.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Every Friday at noon, CITR takes you on a journey through Thunderbird Radio Land. A journey of sound and song, of words and music, of the now and then, of the right here and the far away. It's the Eclectic Lunch, every Friday at 12 noon on Thunderbird Radio, 101.9 FM in beautiful Vancouver.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. We're back now. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Laura Nimmin, a scientist at UBC Center for Health Education Scholarship and Associate Professor in UBC's Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. So far in the past bit, we've talked a bit about the gender balance and how the gender roles play in to medical education and also the practice of medicine. So going forward, I think Gurman, you had a question for Dr. Nimmin.
Yeah, for sure. Going to another aspect of critical theory that I found really interesting was language. So I know for my physiology classes, I have to read like a lot of different articles in medical journals. And the one stood out to me in particular was this article from Spain that was translated into English. And you could tell right off the bat that just from the grammar mistakes alone, this wasn't their person's first language. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in the role that it seems like all reputable, in quotation marks, medical journals are all in English, and what that could play for like foreign medical researchers. Could you maybe talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. It kind of points to sort of this really like the hegemony of sort of medical education and health professions education, that our top journals are English language journals. And so that sort of leaves out the important voices of individuals from other countries who may not have like the sophistication in English to represent their ideas and their work. And I think it's just more what it is more of a reflection of the kind of sort of imperialism and that happens just kind of as a manifestation of who holds power in the world. And so it's just an important, I think in that paper, we just raised it as an important aspect of critical theory to even talk about that and think about that. And we don't often talk about that.
Yeah. I think it's very important for all like medical professionals to just have like this one platform where they can all communicate with each other. And my one worry is that if all the top medical journals were like in different languages, that would just lead to like the segmentation of medicine, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's a very tricky dilemma where it's sort of just like, well, it's a very imperialistic reason why English journals are all the top like medical journals, but at the same time, what else can you do now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it just points to sort of the idea that like it raises the question of who has the authority to speak, right? And and you know, it's easier to kind of legitimize our ideas when we have like such a handle on that particular language that's associated with the top journals in the field. And so just by default, in a sense, it kind of, just diminishes the chances for those other voices to have a chance to articulate their experiences of learning and practice in these different cross-cultural settings where English isn't the dominant language.
I'm not sure if you can speak to this in particular, but do you know how like the culture of medicine differs from like Canada to different countries?
I haven't done myself a lot of cross-cultural work in medical education. Or health professions education. I'd really love to spend more time in that area, but I think I wouldn't really be able to speak to that with a lot of confidence.
Okay, yeah, no worries. So the last question I had before we wrap up was, are there any like hot topics in medical professions education at the moment that would be interesting to talk about?
Gosh, that's so hard because like so much has kind of shifted, I think, even with COVID, in terms of what we value and what is of interest to our community. And I think that COVID really sort of gave us an awakening into the realization of how interconnected we are. And so, you know, the culture of medicine and health professions education too is often kind of centered around this idea of independence and autonomy and individual expertise and so on. And so, you know, I think with like, there's like an ultimate goal to be able to kind of function independently, which is important, but it also sort of has these unspoken rules that emerge, which is like, don't ask for help as a learner, right? And even as a practitioner, and don't reveal gaps of knowledge and don't admit mistakes and don't be vulnerable and reveal experiences or struggles in the learning or clinical environment. And so I think, I think that we're starting to really kind of realize that there are really important social needs of learners and practitioners that really need to be paid attention to. And sort of, you know, the mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical needs as they, I think, are becoming more central to the kind of focus in health professions education lately. And And I think this is sort of paired with our recognition of physician burnout and depression and suicide and things like that, and really difficult manifestations that can arise with the sort of like diminished focus on wellness. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of, you know, the notion of interdependence is sort of at the forefront of a lot of fields. Like, I've just been reading that book by Susan Simard, who's done this really interesting work in the Faculty of Forestry at UBC. You guys should get her on. She might be pretty busy, but she's done some really cool work about trees and how they communicate and how they show their vulnerabilities and vitality in a sort of underground network of fungal filaments that help and support each other. And so I think there's just kind of like, it signals, I think, you know, this focus on our society's growing interest in interconnectivity, not only like as human beings, but our awareness that we're part of this broader social and sort of social ecosystem, I guess, that's both fragile and resilient. And so I think we really need to shift our attention to understand this in all aspects of healthcare, but also learning and just like of the human experience, to be able to kind of, you know, protect each other and protect our earth.
It was very interesting. I think our last guest as well, Richard Cavill, also talked about the research in forestry about the communication between trees. Was that him that said that, Elirod? Mm-hmm. Do you remember? Yeah. Okay. It was.
Yeah.
Him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's super interesting.
Yeah, you know, very interesting that two guests back to back have mentioned that maybe we do need to get her on.
Yeah, if we can. I think she's a little beyond her.
I think she's a little busy. I think they're actually making a movie, like Hollywood movie, of her latest book.
Yeah, it's true. I heard about that a few months ago. They actually like cut a deal or something too.
Yeah. Yeah, but it just shows, I think it signals sort of the impact of that type of thinking and how it's just resonating with people in the world, in society. Like my friends are reading that book, my colleagues, family members, people not in academia. And I just think that there's a real growing interest in our sort of, I don't know, personal spaces even, to think about why that matters. Why does connection matter?
I guess, one question I have just before we wrap things up. So, you know, say someone is in a position like me or Gurman, so like we're finishing our undergrad education or recently graduated and are thinking of going into the field of health professions education. What is one piece of advice you would give to such a person?
I would say to enjoy your experience. And I think that can be cultivated through not thinking of yourself as this isolated person who's going to go through the system being independently sort of assessed and evaluated, and that you need to compete with your peers. I think a better mindset is to go in and foster support around yourself by creating friendships in that environment and finding mentors, and also sustaining your social networks outside of the learning environment. So some of the research a student of mine completed, San Stasiak, showed that having diverse social networks and maintaining your friendships outside of the learning environment actually can create a sense of resiliency and support that's kind of unexpected. And I think, you know, so even just like observing yourself, am I becoming really insular as I go through this program and just only, you know, interacting with medical students in this very intense environment was important. But also thinking about what's happening with my social life outside of this environment, and am I reaching out to people and kind of creating a sense of balance and perspective, that's really important, I think.
It's very interesting. I know in medical schools, there's often this sense of like competitiveness between people. And I guess a part of it's like the nature of the people that go into medicine. A lot of them are just naturally competitive. But at the same time, like, medicine's also a field where you need that sense of community in order to thrive. It's not a place where you can work alone and be successful.
And it's that way through your entire journey as a learner and then also as a practicing healthcare provider. You can't work alone. Like, it's actually puts you at risk for error. You need to work together and collectively and as a team. And so not only for good patient care, but also for that sense of wellness and support. And I think that mindset, and it's like your generation that can shift that too. It's just, do we really need to be here competing? Can we not just, you know, create this sense of collegiality and friendship and really make that a priority? And so it kind of shifts the culture over time.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to leave things off on. It's a pleasure to have you on, Dr. Nitman. It was a great conversation. And thank you so much for your work. It's very important.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me on. It was really an honor and a lot of fun. Thank you. Thanks, and it's really cool what you guys are doing. I really think it's such a neat initiative to give people this a chance to kind of share what they're doing. And you asked such cool questions. So thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. To recap, my name is Alirod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we interviewed Dr. Laura Nitman on Research Review. Dr. Nitman is a scientist at UBC Center for Health Education Scholarship and associate professor in UBC's Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. We thank you for tuning in this week, and we hope you listen to Research Review again 2 weeks from now, broadcasting Wednesday at 6 p.m.